Okay, so I'll talk to you today about mechanisms of the neural mechanisms of vocal control in songbirds. In particular, what I'm really interested in are general mechanisms of sequence generation in neural circuits, in real neural circuits. My collaborators in this work have been Richard Hahnloser, a postdoc in the BCS department at MIT in Sebastian Sun's lab. He's a theorist by training, but he's actually doing great experiments now. So that's an interesting story. A new postdoc of mine, Alex Kozhevnikov, and a graduate student in the CNS department at Caltech in Mark Kanishi's lab, Anthony Leonardo. Okay, so we're all familiar, I mean, sensitivity to temporal sequences is a striking aspect of many different parts of the brain, not only in sensory systems, in visual system, in the auditory system, but also at a motor and cognitive level as well. When we learn the alphabet, for example, we don't just learn 26 uncorrelated symbols. What we really learn is a very specific motor sequence. And if we try to say that sequence in any other order than the one we learned it in, it's actually very difficult to do. So this ability of the brain to step rapidly through a series of learned states underlies not only our ability to say the alphabet and speak, but perhaps our ability to think and plan as well. So I focused on this this problem, and in particular, I'm looking at this in the songbird. Animal vocalizations in general are a great example of complex sequence generation. And then on top of that, some animals like songbirds actually learn their vocalizations. So the circuit not only is able to produce complex sequences, but it's able to learn those sequences in some animals. And animals that can learn their vocalizations besides songbirds are relatively few. Some species of bats have been shown to be able to learn their vocalizations. Whales and humans, even primates, the presence of learned vocalizations is questionable. So these are the birds that I use. I use zebra finches. They're sort of the lab rat of the songbird field. They sing well and breed well in captivity. So they're very commonly used. So there's a lot of literature on these animals. Zebra finches produce a vocalization that looks like this. This is a spectrogram frequency from 0 to 10 kilohertz, and this is about, I think there's a problem with this scale bar. I need to check that. But what's that? Here, I'll play it for you. It doesn't sound anything.
Mahler didn't have chirp.
It doesn't sound anything like Mahler. Okay, so that's one bird. A different bird has a completely different song. And so even though they all kind of sound zebra finchy, right. So there's a common structure to zebra finch songs. And so the first thing you see when a zebra finch sings are a series of introductory notes. These are sort of obligatory, just pulses of sound that come out at the beginning, almost like he's clearing his throat. And then there's a sequence of bursts of sound. You can see one, and this sequence called a motif is repeated a number of times. So here's one motif, here's another motif, here's another motif. Each motif lasts maybe a second long, and each one is broken up into a number of smaller bursts of sound called syllables, which are basically just defined by the fact that they have silence, a little brief silence between them. Okay, so that's the structure of the zebra finch song. One interesting characteristic about bird song in general and zebra finches as well is that the vocalizations are very highly stereotyped. So this is a spectrogram of six sequential renditions of one particular song's syllable. And you can see that even though this syllable is extremely complex acoustically, the acoustic features in the syllable are almost exactly reproduced each time the bird sings that vocalization. Okay, and that fact will come up and be important a little bit later. It's pretty remarkable, isn't it? Now, songbirds learn their vocalizations in a series of steps, just like human beings do. Vocal learning in songbirds usually is broken down into two distinct stages, one in which the songbirds don't vocalize, but rather they just listen to the song tutor, the bird from which they're learning a song. That in songbirds is usually the father, since usually the males sing. And the bird just, he's very young at this point, just a few weeks old, and he just listens. He doesn't make any sounds except for sort of food begging calls. Then at the end of this period, another period begins in which the bird begins to basically babble. He makes sort of random sounds, and over the course of a few months, those babbling sounds gradually converge to produce an adult, very stable song. And in zebra finches, this occurs at about 3 months of age. Now, one interesting thing is that during this, if a bird doesn't hear a tutor song during this period of time, he learns a very abnormal song, and that song doesn't really sound like a song of his species. Another interesting fact is that during this sensory motor period, the bird has to be able to hear himself. So if he's deafened during this sensory motor phase, the song becomes also extremely abnormal, just like in deaf human infants. They can't produce normal species-specific vocalizations. So I mentioned that the song gradually converges to the adult song during this time period, and I can show you an example of this that was recorded by Alfred Chernikovsky when he was at Rockefeller University. The subsong is the song that's produced very early on during this babbling phase. The plastic song is when the song begins to gain some fairly stereotypical structure to it, and then crystallized is the term that's used to refer to the song after it's in the adult state. And then the tutor song, this is what this bird was exposed to during this sensory period. Okay, so let me just show you, play this.
Do all birds come with the same subsong, or is that sort of
variable? It's highly variable. I don't know much about species differences between these things, but the general statement is that the subsong is highly variable, highly sort of random looking. So there's not like one subsong that they sing. So even within one bird, it's highly variable. Okay.
The tutor song
is just the lingo used for the song that the bird is exposed to during this sensory learning period.
Is it exposed to just one
song? No, it has to be exposed to it. Usually what happens is that the male, the father, is on the nest like singing. Okay, and so the juvenile is exposed primarily to that song. And there's also a requirement for social interaction. So he doesn't pick up songs from, you can't train a bird from a loudspeaker. There has to be social interaction. Now this bird was actually trained from a loudspeaker, but it was a model of a bird, and the juvenile actually had to peck at it to make it sing. And that was a sufficient amount of social interaction to make it learn.
Is the crystallized song for one bird same as the tutor song?
The bird can make an almost exact copy of the tutor song, but it doesn't always do that. Especially if there are a bunch of birds in a nest together, they tend to there's some sort of repulsion between them that causes their songs to be different. But if there's a single juvenile in a nest, he will learn an almost exact copy, and then you can make a whole bunch of birds learn an exact copy.
How is the crystallized song for still form the church song. I mean, the church song's got very nice bounds.
Okay.
And the sub-song and plastic song have better bound structure, the song have better bound structure than the Chris Quest song.
I don't know. This is one example of what happened during the learning process. So let me play it for you. I don't know. It's not always exactly the same. Okay. But you'll hear. Okay, so that's the tutor. I'll play that again. Okay, and here's the sub song. Okay. Here's the plastic song. You begin to hear a little bit of repeated structure in there. And here's the crystallized song. Okay, and there's the tutor song again. Okay, so it's pretty close. He's clearly learning the tutor song. To some degree of accuracy.
I think the underlying issue on Mary's question is that, that there's some wavering in the frequencies of function of time in the crystallized song. Sure. And is that, if we compare that with the tutor song, is that sort of the natural time to time or animal to animal fluctuations that you expect? Is that also?
I don't know. This guy is beginning to really study this process of how this crystallization occurs, and there are clearly variability in how well the bird learns the tutor. Often, what happens is that the bird will learn pieces of it and then improvise other pieces. So there's a lot of variability in it, but there's clearly learning going on. Zebra finches actually have one of the more flexible learning periods. I mean, they do a lot more improvisation than many other songbirds do. Let me move on. I don't want to get stuck on this. Now let me. Oh, I seem to have lost a slide. Okay, let me back up. Okay, now the anatomy of the song production and learning system has been explored for the last several decades. And the brain areas involved in motor production and learning have been largely identified. The vocal organ, or the syrinx, is innervated and controlled by motor neurons in the brainstem. This is the nucleus of the 12th nerve. The motor neurons, in turn, receive input from a telencephalic nucleus, nucleus RA, which doesn't stand for anything useful, so it's now just called RA. These premotor neurons, in turn, receive inputs from higher-order premotor neurons called HVC, which is also now doesn't stand for anything. And there are one or two other nuclei that then feed into HVC. And maybe at the end, I'll be able to tell you a little bit about what these guys do up here. But these are the two song control nuclei that most work in the field has focused on. Now there's a separate pathway. So these are vocal. These are motor nuclei. So if any of these brain areas are lesioned bilaterally, the bird no longer sings. Now there are another group of nuclei that are thought to be just involved in learning. So and this is just another pathway from HVC through these three nuclei back to RA. If any of these brain areas are lesioned bilaterally in an adult bird, there's no effect on the song production. So they're not apparently involved in motor production. However, if you lesion these brain areas in a juvenile, the bird no longer learns to vocalize correctly. And So one interesting aspect of this circuit is that the output of the learning circuit projects only to this nucleus RA. So there's something interesting going on here. This is the site at which probably the motor patterning is, to a large extent, programmed. Now, another interesting fact is that these brain areas have now been shown to be highly homologous to brain areas in mammals that are involved in motor learning. For example, nucleus X has a projection to the thalamus that's inhibitory and has cellular morphology that looks very much like the basal ganglion in mammals. And so this is thought to be a cortical basal ganglion thalamocortical loop, just like the basal ganglion, the cortical basal ganglion thalamocortical loop in mammals. So there's reason to believe that what we learn about motor control and learning in this circuit will tell us a lot about what happens in mammals as well. So it's not just some dinosaur brain. There may be direct relevance. Now let me tell you a little bit about neurons and nucleus RA, which is one of the areas that I'll focus on in this talk. There are probably just two cell types in nucleus RA. There are projection neurons, the ones that project down to the motor neurons, and there are also interneurons. And both of these neurons have profuse local collaterals within nucleus RA. The excitatory neurons look very much like integrate and fire neurons. So the firing rate as a function of injected current is fairly linear. There's no intrinsic bursting properties in these neurons, and there's no firing rate adaptation. This comes from a 92 paper from Rich Mooney. Okay, so what I set out to do is to record from lots of neurons in nucleus RA and try to understand what the firing patterns of these neurons are related to song production. And what I wanted to do was to record from as many neurons as I possibly could to get an idea of what the population firing patterns are. And so there are a number of technical challenges involved in doing this. One is that the zebra finch weighs only 12 to 15 grams, which is less than most chronic recording microdrives. So we had to, we actually had to use a new microdrive that was actually developed in David's lab. And now another problem, and that microdrive weighs only roughly a gram. Now the other problem is that zebra finch song production is very strongly suppressed by handling. So when you most microdrives, you pick up the animal and you turn a little screw to advance the electrode and record from to record from different neurons. The problem here is that when you pick up the bird and isolate a cell, you put him back in the cage and he refuses to sing for just about as long as you can hold the cell. So so that was a real problem. So what I did was to make a next generation microdrive that actually has very small synchronous motors on it. These motors weigh about 100 milligrams apiece, and they allowed us to control the position of these electrodes, of three separate electrodes, by remote control. So basically we can just stand there, the bird's inside of the cage, we can just stand there and dial in cells without having to touch the bird. And the whole thing weighs only 1.5 grams. So this is what that looks like on the bird, and I can show you a little movie of what the experiment looks like in progress. Oh, I'm going to skip this because this is...
What is the time between the surgery and the recording session?
A day or so. Surgery takes about 5 hours. This is a zebra finch song slowed down. particularly snazzy song. What? He's got a real sense of rhythm, I think. Okay, so the first thing you'll see is this is the recording setup. There's the microdrive controller that controls the motors, just some amplifiers. That the big box is a sound isolation box. Here's the bird with the microdrive, a tether with the wires, going up to a torque sensor which detects torque on the cable. And that torque is used to feed back to a motor which controls a commutator. A commutator is just a device that allows you to have a bunch of wires connected with complete rotational freedom. The problem is those things take a bit of torque to turn, so the torque sensor feeds back to that and keeps the bird from twisting the cable up. Here's the motorized microdrive. You can see this is three electrodes, and I'm advancing one of them and retracting. And I was really proud of it, so I showed it to you twice. Okay, the next thing you'll see is the bird inside of the cage. And the way we trigger him to sing is just to present a female to him. Believe it or not, it took us a year to figure out exactly how to do this reliably. Now what you hear in the background is a single neuron, single unit recording, and you hear that before the bird sings, it's a very regular firing, and then when he begins to sing, you start getting these high frequency bursts of spikes. So what we'll do is we'll record a cell a bunch of times, and then we'll just, here's an oscilloscope view of. It's an extremely high firing rate, and I'll show you more of that. So what we do is we isolate a cell, trigger the bird to sing, record a bunch of times that he sings, and then we just advance the electrode and find one or two more cells, trigger him to sing, advance the electrode, and just go back and forth like this, and over the course of a week we can record from dozens of cells. By placing the female in front of him. And there are some tricks. You have to change females because he adapts out to one. Exactly. All right, so let me just show you what this looks like visually. So again, before the bird sings, you get this very regular train of action potentials at 20 to 40 hertz. In this neuron. Then when he sings these introductory notes, you can see these high frequency bursts of spikes followed by some sequence of bursts during the song production. And if you zoom in on one motif, you can see these very distinct high frequency bursts. Now, because we're able to record from pairs of neurons, we can actually look at, we can look at two things. One is the reproducibility of the spike train each time the bird sings his song, and we can also look at the timing between the correlations between simultaneously recorded neurons. So one thing you can see.
If you look at the reproducibility of the song itself,
yes.
It always sounds the same.
There's a little bit of time warping, so on the order of a few percent, maybe 5% variability in the duration of the song. But I'll show you later. We take this into account. So these are the spike trains of three simultaneously recorded neurons, one on the red channel and two on the blue channel. So here's one cell, here's another cell. And these signals are just lined up using the onset of the acoustic signal for this particular syllable. Okay, so what we do is we go through this. We go through this we go through all of the songs that we recorded from this bird, and we find the onsets of all of the syllables that he sang. And we can line up the spike trains to that onset. And what you see is that the firing pattern of these cells is extremely reliably reproduced. Okay, the intervals between spikes can be reproduced to less than 100 microseconds, and the intervals between these bursts can be reproduced to less than a millisecond. The other thing that I'm not showing here is that the correlations between spikes in different neurons that were produced at near the same time are also less than less than a millisecond, typically about a half a millisecond. So you have this complex, extremely precisely produced pattern of spikes in nucleus RA.
And is it also working for the working of the atomic cell?
You mean do these intervals within the spikes stretch and contract?
What
we found is that, for example, if the song stretches out there, we don't know yet whether the spikes within a burst stretch out. It's a relatively small effect, okay, and so it's hard to see. We haven't really focused on this question, so I can't really answer your question. What we do know is that there can be very precise intervals between some bursts, and then one pair of bursts has a really sloppy joint in it. Okay, so there are some interesting things to look at there, but we haven't really focused on it. That is suppressed during singing. So what you find is that if you actually stimulate HVC and activate RA neurons, there's a long, slow hyperpolarization that kicks in. It's probably a G protein coupled potassium current.
It's not evident before or after the song. Is that because?
If you look at this one, you see it here. See this suppression here?
Yeah.
And then the spontaneous firing builds back up. You always see this suppression.
So how long before the song starts?
It doesn't. It begins sort of, you can see this first burst probably kicked in enough of that slow hyperpolarization to suppress. There are very few single spikes produced during these burst sequences. Most of the spikes are participating in bursts. Okay, so what we can do then is we can line up the firing patterns of all the neurons that we recorded during the course of this week or so of recording. And so you see here the raster plots of 35 neurons. Yes?
It's really the anatomy that says this is a premotor area that tells me.
These neurons project directly to motor neurons.
Okay, so that's what's telling you it's driving, not listening.
Yes. That's right, and in fact I haven't included data here, but we've shown that you can disturb the auditory feedback, and there's no change in these firing patterns. You can play back very loud sounds while the bird is singing, copies of his song, overlapped with his song, and it doesn't change the firing patterns of these neurons. Okay, so each one of these dots is a spike, each row of dots is the sequence of spikes produced by that neuron during the production of one song motif. And each block of color represents the different renditions of the song motif that we recorded while holding that cell. And the reason why there are different numbers of these for each cell is that for some cells we were only able to record 5 motifs before we lost the cell, and others we were able to record from hundreds.
Can you say what's the role of each neuron in the song that we assign the particular frequency?
That's next. So one of the interesting things is that you see that the that the firing patterns are really dominated by these high-frequency bursts, separated by silence, and so let me just try to let me just show you what the interspike interval histogram looks like for these fire rates, for these firing patterns. This is counts per bin in quarter millisecond bins, and this is interspike interval out to 100 milliseconds. You can see that there's a very large peak at short intervals. This is the same curve expanded out a factor of 10. So you can see that the peak is just under 2 milliseconds. And then there's a very long, almost exponential tail of longer intervals. So these guys are the high frequency bursts, and these guys are the interburst intervals. If you look at the distribution of 1 over interval, so this is the distribution of instantaneous firing rates, what you see is that there's a peak here at very low rates and another peak here at high rates. And so what I would like to argue is that these firing patterns are essentially binary, that the cell is either on or off. Okay. Now, of course, that interpretation requires some understanding of how these things are read out, but at least at the level of coding in RA, we don't see any, we actually see, our results are consistent with the idea that these neurons, for the purposes of coding motor activity are either in an on state or an off state. Yeah.
So this is going to get back to the point about the burst. The first thing you say is on, it's not bursting off.
Right. So
that's your statement.
Right. So here I show you the top, 12 cells from the raster plot. And here what I plotted is just instantaneous firing rate as a function of time for one of those spike trains. So at each time, the instantaneous firing rate is just defined as 1 over the interval between the nearest preceding spike, and the nearest following spike. And you can see that you get these box-like pulses of activity. Okay? And then what we can do is just set a firing rate threshold on this and look at the properties of these binary sequences of states. So one thing we can do is look at the fraction of the fraction of neurons in the on state as a function of that threshold frequency. Of course, at low threshold, this goes to 1, but you can see that at a threshold of a little over 100 hertz, there's a plateau here, and then, of course, as you go to much higher thresholds, it drops off to 0. And this corresponds to about 12% on. So in RA during singing, about 12% of the neurons are in the on state at any given time. And this is average. Okay. Now there are sort of factors of 2 or 3 variation in the fraction on, and we're beginning to understand what that relates to, but I'm not really going to go into that very much today. At any particular, well, it's. I'll tell you quickly, basically, what we think. If you look at this particular bird, there's a factor of 2 increase in the density of bursts at the beginning of each one of these syllables. Okay? All right? But that's what we thought initially. But when we look at all of our other birds, we don't see any such onset variation. Okay. Now, the other thing in what you find is that in other birds, there are harmonic stacks that have very simple acoustic structure. They're just, I'll show you an example later. What you find is that you get a much lower density of bursts during these harmonic stacks. So we thought, well, maybe it's just the complexity of the syllable. So really simple syllables have low firing rates and complex ones have high firing rates. But then what we found is that it's only really the low frequency harmonic stacks that have low firing rate. And the high frequency harmonic stacks like these have a high firing burst rate. Okay, so then basically what we think is that you get more bursts during high frequencies harmonic stacks, and or high pitch sounds, and fewer bursts during low pitch sounds. We don't know why that would be, but that's what we're finding. It could be because the zebra finch syrinx, even when it's denervated, there's no input from the motor neurons. You can cut the nerves. The syrinx is able to produce low frequency harmonic stacks at around 500 to 700 hertz. So one idea is that you just need more activity to drive the syrinx into a high pitch configuration than a low pitch configuration. So that's one possibility. Let's see. I just also wanted to mention that if you set a particular threshold, you can measure the burst width distribution, and you see there's a fairly broad distribution, but the mean is around 10 milliseconds. The other thing is that these onsets and offsets are extremely rapid. So if you take all of those instantaneous firing rate profiles for each burst, and you line them all up at the onset, what you can see is that these bursts, you know, as was relatively clear from the other picture, they don't just sort of ramp up and then ramp down. There's a very sharp transition from a low firing rate state to a high firing rate state that's relatively stationary once the burst is started.
Okay.
Where it goes from low to high, where it crosses a threshold. So this here is the average instantaneous firing rate for all the first intervals in the verse.
If you were to look at the output of very generally, like the output of the neurons in the corpus projecting down to the spinal cord, or the neurons in layer 5 or some other areas, do you get this in mammals? Do you get a similar picture?
Well, okay, one problem there is that there aren't any behaviors that I'm aware of that are reliable enough to actually do that. See, in order to generate these population pictures, we're taking advantage of the fact that the song is so stereotyped that we can just line them all up to sub-millisecond precision.
Maybe swimming or something? Yeah, swimming in a leech or a pattern generator. But
yeah.
That's kind of different because that would be generated in the core.
Yeah. Right. Okay. We can also look at the population average autocorrelation of the instantaneous firing rate for all the cells. So this is for the data set that I just showed you. If you take the autocorrelation of each one of those firing rate traces and average it across the whole population, you see a very large peak here near zero, of course. And the width of that peak is about 10 milliseconds, consistent with the mean burst width. If you look at the population average cross-correlation function between all of those different instantaneous firing rate profiles for each cell, what you see is that this is comparatively flat. So what this says is that kind of what this says, and I'll quantify this a little more later, is that each cell has a unique firing pattern. There isn't some underlying periodicity or something like that that's dominating the firing patterns. So what we can do is actually construct a time correlation matrix between the state of the network at time one and the state of the network at time two. Okay, so on the diagonal, so this is a 35 vector because there are 35 neurons, and at each time we can define a vector of 35 instantaneous firing rates. What's that?
You showed us more than 100 neurons.
No, that was 35 neurons. Yeah. In what?
In this nucleus.
Oh, about 10,000.
It was a random
sample. But we're maybe. I mean, these are the ones we recorded, whatever that means.
They're not in one place.
No, we think they're pretty much. Well, look, we have three electrodes. We plunk them down into the nucleus, and wherever they land is where we sample. They're not, you know, if you look at the sampling points within the nucleus, they're not random. They're along some couple of lines, right? So along the diagonal, of course, the correlation is one. And as you move across the diagonal, what you see is that you get sort of a broad range of noisy looking correlations. There's not a lot of strong structure in these off-diagonal parts of the matrix. Unless, okay, so let me just explain something about how I've organized this data. So there are four syllables produced by this bird, syllable A, B, C, and D, and then this bird stutters syllable D. So he'll produce a string of syllable Ds that are sort of exact copies of this syllable D. Okay, and what you can see is that during this stuttered syllable D, you can see that the correlation between the neural states is extremely high. It's close to one. So what that means is that the pattern of neural states produced by this nucleus during the repetition of this syllable D is the same. Okay?
Yes.
Yes, the correlation matrices look the same, whether they take binary or the analog. I think this was done binary, but it really looks the same.
These are all equal time.
This is time in seconds and time.
This is for just one pair of
units? No, this is for the whole data set. So this is C, T1, T2 is it's the state. And then this is normalized by, you know, it's appropriately normalized to the diagonal as one. So,
but you don't. I mean, you don't record all the neurons at the same time.
No, but they're recorded and then lined up to each other to sub-millisecond precision using the song. So we have a pseudo-simultaneous recording of 35 cells.
And the song is so stereotypical, so it starts stuttering exactly at the same time.
Well, I showed you what it looks like when we line these guys up using the song.
Mike, that's basically a statement that except for that stutter, two neurons are not firing at the same time. The previous statement.
Well, no, there are a lot of neurons that fire at the same time. So if you look at this, 10% of the neurons will be on together. 10 to 12%.
The sort of light blue background, was that number equal, that normalized number equal to 0.1?
I'm not sure I understand the question. What it's saying is that the state at any one time is not correlated to the state at any other time in the song, except when the motor pattern is precisely reproduced.
So what is the blackboard use autocorrelation?
This is a correlate, SI at T1,
right.
SI at T2, and I runs from, you know, 0 to 30, 1 to 35, right? And then this is normalized. Okay? Is that clear?
It's
just, yeah.
Right, but it's between the neuron and the neuron at time, one time, and itself at one time. It's not two different neurons.
It's all the neurons. It's a state. This is a.
What element in the song is a neuron?
Right.
So, okay, so what you can do is you can project. So what I did was I just took out this piece of the matrix that corresponds just to the non-repeating part of the song. And if you project this down, you can basically see the width of this diagonal. And what you see is that the population evolves to an uncorrelated state in about 10 milliseconds. So the width of this is 10 milliseconds, also consistent with the typical burst width. Okay?
Does looks like there's a foreshadowing of this.
There's a little bit here, just a little bit. Now, that actually brings up a point. I want you to notice how similar some of these syllables are. So this syllable here and this syllable are very similar acoustically. They both have this this trailing chirp that has similar frequency. They have this harmonic stack at the end and another little trailing chirp. Okay, these syllables, even though they're so similar acoustically, have only this faint shadow of correlated states here. Okay, and we've tried to quantify this idea that that the neural state is unique at a particular time in the song, much more than it is unique to a particular acoustic event.
It's normalized so that 1.0 is 12%.
No, it's normalized so that the diagonal is 1.
And what's the real value? I mean, what?
7.
I don't know, smart aleck, huh? okay, so one way that we've tried to do this, and I'm not going to go too much into this, but what you can see is that you can construct the same time-time correlation matrix for the acoustic signal. So we just take the song spectrogram and do the same correlation matrix. And what you can see is that there are hot spots all over the place here. So this guy is this band of high, strong correlations between those two syllables that I showed you were very similar but not identical. So you can see these hot spots all over the place. And what you see, so we've tried to figure out how to analyze this basically by looking at I probably should have just put the figure in, but I. This is the neural. Yeah, this is the neural state correlation, and this is the song state correlation, just within the part, the non-repeating part of the song. And so we're trying to quantify the degree to which this is more correlated than this. And one of the ways we've done this is by making a 2D histogram of the correlation at this. Time one, time two point, and this time one, time two point. So we just make a 2D histogram of the correlation values over all of those. And what we find is that there's basically no relationship between the degree of correlation in the song and the degree of correlation in the neural structure.
How do you define the song states again?
These are just spectral vectors. So the state at time one is the spectrogram, is the spectrum of a small window at time one.
So there's no way to look directly at the correlation between the song and the state of the population.
You tell me.
But you look at correlation versus correlation.
Yes.
I guess I'm just asking, suppose you just computed the transfer function between this vector of spice.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems that your claim would be that it actually goes badly because it depends on the absolute time.
Right.
So there'd be no, the first letter kernel would fail. And that seems to be your claim. It depends on absolute time. But did you try?
Okay, say it one more time.
I mean, it seems that you're saying is that absolute time matters because you had similar features in this. If you compute the transfer function from the spike train, the vectors, okay, the vector spike train, and the song, then you should sort of similar spike trains give you similar features. But you're saying that's not true.
Well, no. So what we have is that similar states do give you identical acoustic output. But the statement is that identical acoustic output doesn't give you. Can be produced by many different neural states. Okay, so this is the picture I didn't put in here yet. So if you just make a histogram away from the diagonal of all of the values of the neural correlation along this axis and all the values of the song correlation on this axis, what you find is that even at very high values of the song correlation, there's basically no relationship between the value of the song correlation and the value of the neural correlation.
What is the
many for one.
Yeah.
There are many different
states produce.
Well, so that's what we're trying to get at, is that is the idea that there's an enormous degeneracy in the neural state compared to the song state. There are 10,000 or so neurons in RA. About 1,000 1,000 motor neurons, and about 10.
How you define the spectrum? Like if you went to, let's say, higher precision, maybe you just coarse grained the spectrum.
Well, we have because you have to take a window,
right.
And our window is about 10 to 20 milliseconds. I forget exactly for this picture. It's about 10 to 20 milliseconds, but it's on the order of one state width of the neural signal. So it's not. You know, it's not many factors of two different. It's at most one factor.
The spectrogram is the right representation.
I agree. There is a problem there with different time scales, different graining. So. It could. If you have any specific suggestions, I'd be delighted to talk to you about that.
But you mentioned going from 10,000 neurons in an array to 1,000 array.
Yes, so 10.
Okay. Have you recorded with some arrays?
No. It's, you know what? Something bad is happening here. That's bad. All right, here we go. Okay.
Can I just ask, what is the reason to think that the connection between neural activity and the song has to be instantaneous?
Oh.
Why couldn't the transfer function?
So, obviously, there's some latency. Okay. We estimate that the latency between RA and the vocal output is going to be on the order of 10 milliseconds. We've directly measured the latency of bursts in RA, this is in an anesthetized animal, of bursts in RA to the nerve almost at the syrinx, and that's about 7 milliseconds, and then you can tack on a few more milliseconds just to get to the muscles and get some configuration change in the syrinx. So all of these calculations were done, including a 10 millisecond shift delay of the neural signal relative to the acoustic signal to take into account potential latency.
Right, but that's just the propagation delay, but I'll...
Oh, you're talking about instantaneous...
I think I'll sing this note, but, you know, I can sing it a second later.
No. These are premotor neurons. These go right to the motor neurons. There's no 1 second delay here.
Well, but I can extend that argument all the way back. You know, I can say that the neurons that are before those are also have to be. Brain has to be.
Okay, all right. Let's put that aside. I don't know how to answer that question. You had a question?
Just repeat Amisha's question, but I didn't get the answer. Why don't you just correlate the same method you're taking, whether it's, you don't correlate the signal or the sound with the neural pattern? You have just two patterns. You could just do the same analysis, then you would find both pattern shifts.
You mean directly to the acoustic signal?
The acoustic signal is not
reliable enough to do that kind of thing. How do I put this? If you just look directly at the pressure waveform recorded on the microphone, what you mostly see is that the amplitude profile looks fairly reliable. But you can see that the frequencies are similar. But other than that, there's no precise phase relationship between the song produced at one time and the song produced at another time.
Well, why not just use the amplitudes if you use them? So why the traces in the first place? The traces in the first place.
No, the traces. Well, you can align the traces using the amplitude. But the amplitude is a very impoverished representation of the song.
Amplitude is basically the collapsing spectrum of the
frequency. Maybe I don't understand something. I thought having worked at the phone company once, I thought what they do is throw out all the phases.
No, that's phase. Oh, yeah, but that's a spectrogram. That's what we're doing.
to the angle of the set.
Yeah.
It's just sound perspective.
No, okay, that's interesting.
But if you want to talk about the amplitude of each frequency bin, that's just a spectrogram of each narrow band in frequency.
So you can't see the spectrogram as a vector, and then you recorded the spikes as a vector?
That's what I've done here. I've
shown.
No. This is the cross correlation of the vector of spectra at time one versus time two.
Yeah, but you could do put on one axis the spectrogram and on the other axis.
Well, it's a vector of different length, so you have to. Can you cross correlate directly the vector of spectrograms with the vector of the space?
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about that. I have like a lot of things to cover, so I'd love to talk to you about this, but I'm going to be here all week, so there's no reason to do this right now. Okay. So the other thing that I want to look at was the distribution of correlation values in the correlation matrix. Okay. So again, what I've done is I've blocked out the diagonal, so 10 milliseconds around the diagonal, because we don't really care about that at this point. And so this is the distribution of correlation values from 1 to minus 1. And you can see this big peak here just below 0. This is with the data set mean subtracted. And a long tail up here to high correlations. And then if you look at the distribution function, what I'm showing here is the distribution function of correlation values near one. Okay, so this heavy black line is just this line shown on a log scale. Okay, and then what I do is I take all of the states and all of the firing rates for each cell and give each cell a random time shift, some large, you know, over a uniform interval of a couple seconds. Okay, and it's wrapped around. All right. So basically, I've totally scrambled the correlations between the different neurons, but I've kept the same distribution of burst widths and so on. Okay, and I look at the same distribution for these randomized data sets, and that's what's shown here. So for each random one, I calculate the distribution function of correlations and there's a distribution over the 1,000 runs or so, and I just plot the red band is the 95% confidence interval, the 2 sigma confidence interval, and the green band is the 1 sigma confidence interval for those correlation values. So what this is basically saying is that the distribution of correlation values in the real data is essentially the same as that for a random matrix. Any screams and yells yet? No?
So you have a random
data. and then this just gets back to this question of analog versus binary. You can also look at this distribution of correlation values for the raw firing rate traces versus using a binarized version of the data set. And what you can see is that the very highest correlations get kicked up to 1. Get kicked up to higher values when you binarize. But above about a correlation of 0.9, there's really no difference between the correlation functions of the real firing rate traces versus the binarized. So this was support for the idea that it's a fairly binary state. So okay, so this summarizes each RA neuron generates a unique pattern of bursts. The state evolves to an uncorrelated state in about 10 milliseconds, and RA states are uniquely related to time in the song and not an acoustic signal. Let me just make one other point, and that is that these narrow bursts in time appear to be unrelated to the time scale of the motor activity. So a highly modulated acoustic signal is associated with a sequence of brief bursts in RA, but essentially a constant motor output, this harmonic stack at a constant frequency, is also associated with a sequence of brief bursts. Okay, and the distribution of burst widths during these constant harmonic stacks is the same as during these more complex portions of the syllable. So, so we can actually, another way to say that is that that corresponds to the width of the diagonal. So we set a threshold. So this is the song correlation matrix, and we just measure the width, just a sample of the width along the diagonal at some threshold value, which I think was 0.5. And we can do the same thing for the neural signal. We just sample the width of the diagonal at all positions, at all times, and plot one versus the other. And what you can see is that there's no relationship between the width, between the persistence time of the motor output and the persistence time of the neural state. So the neural state just keeps chunking along, evolving to an uncorrelated state every 10 milliseconds, even when the song is persistent on a much longer time scale.
So this text sounds like nothing happened, there's no change. You say for 100 milliseconds you have a basically constant spectrum.
Yes.
And it really sounds like if you listen to it, can you identify this case?
It just, what do you mean if you, can you identify what? These,
yeah, this
these things, well.
No, this appears when there's some
better. Oh yeah, it just, it sounds like, you know, it's just a constant, you know, it's just a constant output. The neurons keep.
That's why it's made in one.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
But the fact that it's a nice stack of harmonics doesn't mean nothing happens. It means that the signal is very periodic. It doesn't mean that.
The syrinx can generate these signals without any motor input at all. Okay. In other words, the point is that the motor output, the muscle output, as measured by the syrinx, is stationary.
What do you mean exactly by stationary? The muscles must move because something moves in order to produce the sound.
No. The vocal organ of the bird works very much like ours. It's not driven by neural activity. The periodicity involved in producing the sound is produced by it's basically a Bernoulli oscillator. It's not a neurally driven.
It's
been shown that proprioceptive feedback is not required for motor production. So you can. There is, but you can cut it, and there's no effect on the song production. You can also cut the nerves going to the syrinx, and you get, and the whole song becomes a series of harmonic stacks. So clearly, neural input to the syrinx is not required for this behavior.
So these bursts are somehow disconnected.
Well, so the idea for this is relatively trivial. I mean, you have this population of 10 to the 4 RA neurons, and you have some projection down onto let's just make this one motor channel, so one muscle, okay? And clearly, so you've got about 10,000 neurons here, and 10 motor groups here, and 10. So at any how do I put this? I should have written down these numbers. But basically the idea is that you can produce a very slowly modulated motor output by summing together some appropriately phased group of pulses, like this. Okay? And you can produce a highly rapidly modulated output by summing together a group of pulses like this with a slightly different phasing relationship. So you can produce a wide range of timescales in the motor output with the same underlying neural dynamics. You don't have to slow down you know, the neural circuitry, the biophysics of this circuit to produce, to go from a rapidly changing acoustic signal to a slowly changing one.
It's like a CD.
It's almost like, you know, some distributed digital representation, and the other point is that because you've got, you know, about 10,000 neurons here, and 10% of them on, you've got 10,000 choose 1,000 ways to assign that state. So if you had all those neurons converging to one, you would have an enormous number of ways to choose that state to give you the same output.
But in that motor output, 12.
Yeah.
These neurons are fast enough that they can think about it. It's known from other measurements that have been shown, I guess, that these nearest neurons are fast enough to follow the transitions from RA. I mean, they're not just, the claim is they're not just integrating, they just have a long integration.
Well, the song can have modulations on a 10 millisecond time scale. So clearly the motor output is capable of producing rapid modulations. So I don't know that anybody's specifically measured these neurons, but it's clear that the behavior supports the idea that you can have this sort of full 100 hertz bandwidth transmitted to the periphery. What time is it?
It's 10:23.
Okay. So respiratory areas also get input from RA, and RA also projects to another brain area that actually sort of completes a loop back up to HVC. So,
because if you think of the two, I mean, it's useful information about the right networks that you might also be the respiratory muscles. The airflow, because not only the muscles of the vocal organ, but also the airflow would determine the song.
Mm-hmm. I would guess that the air sac pressure would probably not have more structure than the acoustic signal. Is it? I'm not sure I understand your question. It seems like it would probably reasonably follow the basically the amplitude roughly of the acoustic signals.
Is there a competing model that you have as a test? Is there some competing model you take them?
Well, okay, all right. So what are some problems with interpreting this? One is that one criticism that I've heard is that the fact that these firing patterns are so highly reproduced each time the bird sings his song suggests that it's that way for a reason, you know, that those patterns are actually required to generate the motor output. And the fact that they're so stereotyped suggests that, okay? Now, what I'll argue later is that the reason why these firing patterns are so stereotyped is that they're actually being driven by a very sparse input from the next higher stage, okay, and that the randomness of these burst patterns is just an artifact of the high degree of convergence from these neurons onto muscles. I don't really know. I can't really think of a good competing hypothesis. One possibility is that, you know, I said that these two neural signals are very similar, but not identical, and these sequence of states are essentially uncorrelated between these two syllables. It could be that the sequence is different because the acoustic signals are different. They're not identical. And so, you know, it's... Yeah, I don't remember his exact comment, but the point is that whatever differences are here reflect the differences in the output. So that's another possibility. It's just that if you look at correlations between these acoustic states, they're just much stronger than the correlations in the neural states. So it's suggested.
I guess the thing that is just a little bothersome when you do the summation, sort of implicit in your picture, is that there's no holes in the middle.
No holes.
Well, that's sort of well, gets the flavor that this thing is tightly tied, sort of clock in some sense. And if there was a slowly drop out in the runs from RA, in the songbird, he would, rather than having these long periods being on, he'd sort of drop out. You drop out activity. Do you ever see fluctuation?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
If you go back to that one picture.
Which?
The little model picture.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, but that's only four neurons. This nucleus has, 10,000.
No, I understand. So, I mean, is there a way to...
So, even with 35 neurons, we've completely filled the state space. We've got a defined state at all times with only 30, with roughly 35 neurons.
So if you had light up into RA and slowly drop out fractions of the cells, you would expect that the thing would be failed sort of...
Very gracefully. It's a very robust representation. That's right.
You say the mass, there exists some feed-forward neural networks, so that if you feed in the 0-1 patterns, bursts or no bursts, and you can predict the vector of spectrograms.
Sort of just a model of this coding?
Yeah. This picture is a feed-forward neural network.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've cooked up a just totally Mickey Mouse model where I've got, 2,000 of these guys and two motor channels. And these projections here can be either, one or minus one. Okay. And then what happens is you can actually learn a sequence of states by adding or dropping bursts from the RA state at any particular time, so that you can basically construct whatever analog signal you want at the output. And what happens is that the way the learning occurs is that you're not learning some bunch of precise synaptic weights. What you're learning is just this temporal sequence of states. Okay. And so the interesting idea is that the reason why the learning happens here in RA as opposed to here is because one possibility is that there are just anatomical constraints on this. I'm not saying this very clearly. In other words, you have this learning circuit that projects to RA and not to the brainstem. So how do you learn an analog sequence down here? Well, you learn the sequence of states to go through rather than learning analog synaptic values. We should probably take a break because then I have another what the input is to RA.
Okay. Why don't we meet back at 11:15?
Too late. No, go ahead.
So there's this crystallization. Is there also something like a decrystallization?
Yeah. Now that you mention it. If you take an adult bird, and while he's singing, you play back distorted auditory feedback. The song actually degrades rather rapidly over the course of a few days. So there's no effect in the acoustic pattern to sort of online, how do I put this? There's no online change in the acoustic pattern when you distort the auditory feedback. And if you deafen the bird, he sings just as well as when he can hear. But there's a degradation of the song if you deafen the bird and if you distort auditory feedback that happens over a few days. And then that recovers. Okay, so very simple question. Are these patterns generated by internal circuitry within RA, or are they imposed from inputs from the higher premotor areas?
I remember correctly, but you showed that the correlation between pairs of neurons and RA is small.
Correlation is small. That's what? Right. Well, you have to be a little careful. Between different pairs, if you were to record two cells in RA simultaneously and record a bunch of times the bird sings, there would be enormous correlations between them because each one is doing exactly the same thing. But if you average over the whole population, then the correlations are very weak, just in the sense that each neuron is generating its own unique pattern. Okay, so just to put a real comic book sort of mindset on this, so we can think about the temporal structure in RA, and we can imagine that that this sort of 10 millisecond evolution of the state is produced by intrinsic dynamics. So you could have some sort of oscillatory circuit or some other dynamics in here that produces 10 millisecond timescale within RA, and that the input from HPC is relatively stationary. On the other hand, the temporal structure in RA could essentially be driven or clocked perhaps by inputs from HPC. And there is some there's some evidence that suggests that that the temporal structure in RA may be actually intrinsic within RA, and that is in a paper from Dan Margoliash's lab in '96. He did a single unit, if that's what you can call it, recordings in nucleus HVC, and showed that the firing patterns in HVC during singing are essentially just, they're much more weakly modulated than the firing patterns in RA, and they're much more stochastic. So this sort of more uniform firing patterns in HVC almost suggests that these rapid state transitions in RA are being produced by intrinsic circuitry. No. We'll get there.
Is there feedback from RA?
No. It's unidirectional.
Unidirectional.
So HVC projects to RA, but there is no known projection back from RA to HVC. And that's true, actually, surprisingly, that's true at all levels of the song control system. So unlike cortex, there aren't these very strong feedback projections within each brain area.
Aren't there loops eventually?
Yes, but I don't think that was what your question was. Is
that was not my question.
Okay. There, RA does talk to a midbrain vocalization area, DM, which then feeds back to UVA, which projects to HVC. So there is evidence for a loop, although its functionality in this circuit isn't known. Well, if you lesion any of those areas in the loop, the bird doesn't sing anymore, but that doesn't mean that the feedback from RA to DM is what's doing it.
I mean, would you see patterns if you cut the feedback? I mean, tempo patterns?
I have no idea. I haven't done the experiment. I can't answer your question. I don't know. It's an intriguing idea, but I don't see any way to predict that without actually doing the experiment. Okay, so then the other question is, there's also this sort of spatial structure in the state at a particular time. And, you know, of course, one idea is that that could be produced by some sort of lateral inhibition within RA that produces a particular state, and that the input from HVC is spatially uniform and essentially just drives RA with some bias term. And then the other possibility is that, of course, the other possibility is that the spatial structure within RA is driven directly from HVC. So this is just sort of a cartoon view of the extremes that one might imagine. Now, there is a recent observation which actually suggested a very powerful way to address the issue that I just brought up to you. So this is a recent paper also out of Dan Margolyash's lab showing that when the zebra finch is asleep, you get spontaneous patterns of bursts. And what he did was he recorded from one of these neurons in the sleeping bird, recorded the pattern of spikes, woke the bird up, got him to sing, and recorded the pattern of spikes from that same neuron. Now, then taking this motor pattern, he was able to search through all of the bursts that he found in the sleeping bird. And lo and behold, occasionally you find these sequences of bursts in the sleeping bird that very closely match the motor pattern that you find in the singing bird. And more often what you find are just little pieces rather than a whole song motif.
But the bird doesn't sing.
He's not singing in his sleep,
so
but
where's the output?
I don't know where the output's blocked. It's an interesting question. You know, it may be some neuromodulatory thing at the motor neurons. Well, that's right. You don't know, but he has done paired recording, so he's shown that at least two guys are following the same.
At the same time.
Following the pattern. That's right. At the same time. And this is just another example.
Female birds.
Well, I don't know if they're dreaming of female birds. they're. But probably, if one wanted to be loose about it, you could say they were dreaming that they're singing. I don't know what their motivation would be, but birds sing a lot of what's called undirected song, which means they just sing for the fun of it. So he has this whole theory about what this means for song learning. But I got really excited about this because the year before I had actually developed an experimental preparation to record these spontaneous bursts, which I had also seen. But I actually gave up on that because I thought that these didn't really have anything to do with singing and they were just sort of thalamic spindles or whatever. I didn't see a point in investing a lot of time in studying them. But this actually really supports the idea that that whatever mechanisms underlie the production of these motor patterns during singing may actually be there during the production of the same patterns during sleep. Okay, it's a guess, right? So what I decided to do was to try to understand the origin of these burst patterns in the sleeping bird, to give us a hint as to what's actually happening in the singing bird, okay? And and here's the reason why it's easier to do this in the sleeping bird. The sleeping bird, you can take a bird, head fix him, put him in the apparatus, and most of the time he just falls asleep, okay? You'll never ever get him to sing with his head fixed. They just won't do it. They only sing if they're feeling really loosey-goosey, you know, I mean. I mean, you can imagine, from what I told you before, even if you just pick them up and put them back, you can't get them to sing. So, okay, so what we do is we take a bird, head fix it, put it in the apparatus, and actually what we found is that we can get a much more reliable sleep state if we administer a small amount of melatonin, which is known to regulate the sleep cycle in birds. And so the birds are unanesthetized and very slightly drugged, okay, with melatonin. And we've actually looked at our results with and without melatonin, and we get the same answer. So what I'll show you applies, I believe, to birds that are sleeping without melatonin. Okay, so one problem is that HVC is not a homogeneous population of neurons. There are three types of neurons that have been identified in HVC, one of which projects to RA, one of which projects to this learning area, area X, and another is a local interneuron that's probably inhibitory, although that hasn't been demonstrated. So these three types have been identified by intracellular recording. They have different electrophysiological properties, and by filling them with neurobiotin, you can identify the three classes by their projection. And so what we do is we want to make recordings in HVC, but we want to know which of these cells we're recording from. So we do antidromic identification of the neuron types by electrical stimulation in RA or stimulation in X or both. And so what we find is that we can very clearly identify these three kinds of neurons. If we stimulate in area X, we find one cell type that responds to stimulation in X, but not to this is one cell type that responds to stimulation in X, but not to stimulation in RA. And we've done a collision test so that if we stimulate after a spontaneous spike, we don't get antidromic activation of the neuron. We find a second neuron type that responds to stimulation in RA, but not to X, and also antidromic or collision to stimulation following spontaneous events, stimulation in RA. And we find a third cell type that also responds only to stimulation in RA and has no collision to RA stimulation. And
difference between second and third is
more types? This and this? Two things. There's no collision for this type, and there is collision for this type. Okay? It's kind of obvious what we're thinking here. These are the X projecting neurons, these are the RA projecting neurons, and these are the interneurons. And the interesting thing here is that the interneurons appear to only be able to be stimulated by activation of the RA projecting neurons. You can analyze the latency variability of each of these three types, and you see that the latency variability of the X projecting types is on the order of 30 microseconds. The latency variability of the RA projecting type to RA stimulation is also about 30 microseconds. And the latency variability of the interneuron is closer to a millisecond.
And there is spread. That's
this is a log plot. It's a little bit more, but the point is that there's a very clear separation between these classes of neurons. You stimulate, you look at it on the scope, and it's just really obvious which one you're looking to. The other thing is that these guys generate lots of spikes when you turn up the stimulus intensity, and these guys generate only one or two spikes, no matter how high you turn up the stimulus. So they're just trivial to tell apart by using antidromic activation. The other interesting thing is that these guys have a very, very low spontaneous firing rate. These guys have a high spontaneous firing rate. So if you don't have this stimulation in RA and X, you'll never see one of these. They're essentially dead silent in the awake bird. Okay, but if you stimulate, so we just have a search stimulus and we just go down until we find one of these cells. And so we can record from these. And the other point here is that it appears that there's a very strong connection from the RA projecting neurons to the interneurons, but a much weaker connection from the X projecting neurons to the interneurons. And we don't understand why that is or what that means, but it'll... in the awake bird, non-singing, the firing rates vary between sort of 1 and 20 hertz. These guys will generate basically we've never seen a spike in one of these guys in an awake bird that we knew was awake. And we've quantified the awake and sleep states in these experiments by EEG recordings, looking at awake and sleep EEG states. We seem to hit these things with fairly equal probability. Now, let me just make one other point that you brought up before about this guy. All of these neurons recorded in this previous study had spontaneous activity. And they're the only ones you can find if you just put an electrode into HVC. So we think that all of these neurons were, in fact, interneurons. Okay. So then what we did was we did recordings from pairs and triplets of neurons in HVC, identified neurons in HVC and neurons in RA. And this shows an example of instantaneous firing rate of an HVC interneuron, an HVC RA projecting neuron, and an RA neuron. This is a triplet simultaneous recording in the sleeping bird. And what you can see is that the HVC interneuron has a very high density of bursts. And the RA neuron has sort of an intermediate density. And the RA projecting HVC neuron has an extremely low density of bursts. Okay?
Does RA burst precede the
interneuron burst? I'll show you all those firing relationships in a minute. So this just quantifies the burst, the ratio of burst densities. These are all from paired recordings. Each one of these points is a single paired recording. What you can see is that the interneurons produce about 3.5 times as many bursts per unit time as the RA neurons. The RA neurons produce about roughly 10 to 12 times as many bursts as the RA projecting neurons. Okay, and likewise, the interneurons versus the RA projecting neurons had a firing burst ratio of close to 40. Okay, so the point here is that the interneurons, the HVC RA neurons are bursting extremely rarely during the sleep bursts. Now, if you look at paired recordings of interneurons, what you find is that the interneurons are highly synchronized. So just about every burst in one interneuron is associated with a burst in another interneuron. Okay, and you can see the typical cross-correlation here is a strong peak at zero with a width. The bursts are, as in the singing bird, approximately 10 milliseconds wide. On the other hand, if you record from RA neurons, pairs of RA neurons during sleep, what you find is that the RA neurons are much less synchronized. You see that only occasionally is a burst in one RA neuron synchronized with a burst in the other RA neuron. The majority of these bursts occur independently. In fact, one thing you see here is that the bursts in one RA neuron are often associated with a brief suppression of the spontaneous activity in the other interneuron. Nevertheless, these things still do have a significant pairwise cross-correlation because of these coincident bursts. Now, so this just shows the, just ignore this for a moment. I'll explain what that means in a minute. This explains essentially the correlation coefficient in the burst patterns of RA pairs and interneuron pairs. And you can see that the interneurons have a much higher correlation of about 0.75 compared to the RA pairs, which are down here at about 0.25. Okay, the RA to HVC interneuron pairs are kind of spread out all over the place, but they're more intermediate in their correlation. Okay, so you have these correlated bursting events in HVC producing much more weakly correlated patterns of bursts in RA. Okay, now let me just remind you that this is reminiscent of the lack of correlation between burst patterns in during singing. Okay.
If we look at the top trace, is that peaking the RA to the zero to HVC?
What's that?
Is that time peaking away from zero?
Oh, here. Oh, I forgot to mention this other axis. This is the time lag of the peak of the cross correlation. These are predominantly close to zero. Okay. Now, if you record from an RA projecting neuron, an HVC RA projecting neuron, and an RA neuron simultaneously, this HVC RA neuron is bursting rarely, but if you show the raster plot of the firing of the RA neuron in black, lined up to the onsets of the HVC RA bursts, what you see is that there's actually a pattern, a fairly reliably reproduced pattern associated with the firing of that HVC RA neuron.
Right, I guess I'm confused between this data and the previous data.
Mm-hmm. This is an HVC RA and an RA pair.
Because this, yeah, okay, maybe. This would suggest that there's a time delay, propagation or whatever, but the previous correlation showed nothing.
Wait. Right. Okay, so good point. The time lags of sort of the peaks of these correlations to these, the peaks of the correlation between the RA and the HVC RA neurons is all over the place, right? And that's just because you get these peaks in the correlation at all different times, right? So is the problem understanding what I'm showing or an interpretation issue?
I guess it's an interpretation.
Okay, if it's an interpretation, let's just skip it because I'll get to that in just a minute. Okay. And what we find is that each RA cell has a fairly unique pattern. So this just shows a different RA neuron recorded simultaneously with the same HVC RA neuron. Okay. And these two examples are examples where there's a fairly strong correlation, meaning that the peak here is fairly high. Okay, but you can see if you look over the whole data set, there's a wide distribution of the degree to which this pattern is highly correlated with that firing. So it varies from, you know, from one all the way down to very small values. So not all RA neuron, HVC RA, RA neuron pairs show strong correlations like this. Okay. And then if we look at a simultaneous recording of an HVC RA neuron with an interneuron, what we see is that there's typically a sum here, but there's typically a peak near zero time here in this correlation function. But more importantly, there's sort of a broad peak of activity in the interneuron around the time at which the HVC RA neuron fired. So the idea is that we have a hundred or couple hundred millisecond interval in which we're getting a sequence of bursts in the RA neuron. Okay, sort of a mini sequence, a little subset of what that neuron is producing when the bird sings. okay? And that's associated in the interneuron with a burst of activity that actually looks very much like what you and Margoliash found in the singing bird, okay? Now, so the idea that we had is that each one of those RA bursts, each one of the bursts in those RA neurons is being driven by a population of HVC RA neurons. Okay, so the idea is that there's one HVC RA neuron that's driving bursts in RA at this time, and another HVC RA neuron that's driving bursts at that time, and another HVC RA neuron that's driving bursts at this time, and so on. So that each one of these events in RA is being driven by an HVC RA neuron. Right, and that's and one prediction of that idea would be that the HVC RA neurons could not be synchronized. That if you look at pairs of HVC RA neurons, that they don't fire simultaneously. See, one idea would be that all the HVC RA neurons could go at once and drive some sort of dynamics within RA. Okay. But in fact, the HVCRA neurons are not synchronized. We've recorded from six pairs of these, and they're always firing completely independently at different times. Okay. So the idea that we have is that there is a sequence of subpopulations within these within the HVCRA population that fire at one particular time, drive some pattern of activity in RA, and then sometime later another subpopulation fires and drives a completely different pattern of activity in RA. And so you can imagine that during singing, so now what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a little jump and extrapolate to what might be happening during singing. And that is that is that each 10 millisecond state in the song is being driven by some population of neurons in HVC that only fires once during the song, okay? And support for the idea that these guys fire only once during this motor pattern is given by a couple of things. First,
The data is just that the interneurons receive input, but you have no idea what they can put a spell in.
We don't know what the relationship is between these guys and these guys. We know from the antidromic stimulation experiments that these guys are strongly activated by these. We also have a strong synchrony in sleep between these and these guys, between these and these guys. Basically, these are highly synchronized to everybody. So we suspect there's a very large convergence of this population onto the interneurons.
But there's no evidence for arrows out of that population.
I have no idea.
Okay.
I mean, these guys ramify widely within HVC, so, but we don't know to whom.
Okay. And what causes the clocking from?
Okay. So this is a picture that's devoid of dynamics at this time. Okay. This is just a representation. We're trying to figure out right now what actually is producing this sequence. But let me just turn back one second because that's sort of more interpretation. These guys, when they're correlated when the RA neuron is correlated to the HVC RA neuron, there's always a unique pattern. You don't see one pattern sometimes and a completely different pattern other times. Okay, so that suggests that HVC RA neuron is associated with a unique sequence in the RA pattern. Okay, so that's one line of evidence that an HVC RA neuron might be bursting only once during the song. Another point is that RA neurons burst produce about 10 bursts during a song motif during singing. The HVCRA neurons are bursting about 10 to 15 times less often than the RA neurons. So it's consistent with the idea that the HVCRA neurons, let me say that again just for clarity, during sleep, these guys are bursting 10 times less often than those guys. So it suggests that during singing, if that number holds up the same, that the HVCRA neuron would be bursting only once. So obviously, what we're trying to do right now is to record from these neurons in the singing bird. And now that we have developed this technique of antidromically identifying these neurons, we're working hard to record from these guys in the singing bird to test this idea. But the interesting point here is that these neurons as a population have an explicit representation of time. There's, when that neuron is on, it's that particular unique time in the song. Okay? And this agrees with what I was telling you an hour ago, that the relationship between this and what I was saying before is that this guy can drive a completely uncorrelated pattern of states relative to this guy. There's no reason for there to be any correlation between the states driven by these different neurons. Okay? It's not a clock in the usual sense of like a computer clock, because a computer clock has a universal signal. There's no spatial structure in it, right? It just drives transitions in downstream structures, right? This is different. This is not like a metronome. Clock is a word that's used in many different contexts. So a computer clock simply drives transitions, and it's a uniform signal. This is more like a counter, essentially, that identifies a particular state that the downstream structure should be in. And there's a very interesting relationship to learning now. It could. I mean, you could have, this guy not connected to anybody. I don't. There's no reason why that couldn't happen. No, this is just a cartoon picture. I mean,
what you're saying is that because early on you said that different patterns of activity in RA can drive very similar acoustical motifs, is that the word?
Acoustical signal.
Signal.
Yeah.
All right. Stop. Syllables. So then, your idea here is that like 1 and 3 could be very, very similar acoustically.
Yeah.
But this provides a basis why you get different patterns of activity.
Right. If the spectral structure at time 1 and time 3 is supposed to be the same, then all you need to do is have 1 connect to some pattern in RA that produces a particular configuration, and 3 drive some other pattern that produces the same configuration. Because of the convergence, those don't have to be the same.
Right.
But the point is that the state here will be associated with a particular time, not with a particular acoustic structure.
Right.
And so this gives a very natural explanation for why that could happen.
And then, I'm sorry, just earlier on you said the learning is believed to take place.
So here's a very simple relationship to learning now. Let's say that you make an error. Let's say that the acoustic signal has an error in it relative to the template, song, at this time. Okay? So if there's an error in the acoustic output at this time, you only need to modify the synapses that were active at that time, coming from this neuron. And you can modify those synapses as much as you want, and it will have no effect on the song anywhere else. So unlike other models of sequence generation, such as SynFire chains, where you have a complex interaction of a propagating wave of activity. If you change the synapses at one point to fix a state at this time, you can completely change the trajectory of states at other times. And so you have this problem of sort of temporal credit assignment, how to fix the state at one time without screwing everything else up. And this naturally solves that problem.
If this model is true, wouldn't you see a peak in the cross parallelogram between 2HPC now shifted by 10 to the neurons?
2HPC RA neurons?
Yeah.
Like that?
Yeah. That's state to state.
No, this is just 2HPC RA neurons.
But it's not too precise.
Yeah, but it's a sleeping bird. There's nothing to.
The singing bird, this would become trouble.
I would expect these to be absolutely lined up.
As you see in our.
I mean, you also see, if you look at these patterns, that the reliability of this pattern decreases as you move away. So there's this sort of mini sequence that you get in RA, but it gets ratty around the edges. So sometimes it seems like the sequence is really short, like you may only get two bursts, and other times it seems long, like here. You get a lot. And in the two cases that Margolyev showed in his paper, it appears that the whole motif sequence was produced. But in our hands, the time scale of the mini sequences is more often in the range of 100 milliseconds.
How many of these HVCRNs are in your?
Pairs? This shows 32 pairs.
No, how many there are?
Oh, HVCRA. There are sort of again, order 10,000 HVC neurons. I mean, factors of two or three. I don't know, but several thousand. So if there are 100 states and you have 10,000 neurons, then you have 100 neurons on per burst, per state.
And so these hundreds, if you happen to record them, they would burst all the time.
If you were to be so lucky to record from 100 neurons and then record from those 100 neurons. if you were to record from two neurons, well, yes, I would expect that if I sat there or Richard Hahnloser sat there in the lab long enough, he would eventually record from two neurons that had fairly synchronized firing.
So going back to your question of learning, so the idea is, as long as you have a repeatable spatial temporal pattern, or a repeatable pattern in HPC, then it doesn't matter what that pattern is, you can just learn the proper connections to make it
ourselves. Exactly. So, right. That's right. Now, remember I made this distinction before between the stuttered syllable, which is acoustically identical, and you see the neural states are identical. What I would suggest happens in that case is that the little string of HVCRA neurons that's being run through to produce that syllable is actually repeating precisely. So the motor pattern is actually precisely reproduced in that case. Yeah.
So it seems that just from this model, I'm just taking it seriously. That there's sort of two aspects of the learning, if I understand correctly. One is you have to get the log scale structure correct, which is organizing the states. And then you have to get sort of the detailed structure for exactly what that state means as far as turning on different motor neurons via RA.
Right.
So do you see this sort of large-scale structure then refinement of short-scale structure in learning in ZebraFinch? Is there some clue from the learning of songs that bears on this?
Well, I think that what's known now is perhaps consistent with the idea. It's consistent with this idea that you basically have a counter and you fill in the features sort of in situ that are associated at different times of the song. In other words, it doesn't seem like the bird learns a syllable and another syllable and then puts them in the right order. Okay, so he has a noisy pattern that he produces, and uniformly across that pattern, things begin to converge to their
values. Would you predict that unlearning or melting would occur in opposite sequence?
I don't know. So I don't know. The decrystallization that you get when you play the bird back distorted acoustic signals actually occurs in a very strange way. The bird begins to stutter a lot of syllables. That's the first thing that happens, which I don't know how to relate that to this model.
Could it suggest an HVC?
It suggests that something may be happening here. That's right.
Right,
yeah. Well, you also get, and then you can also get changes in syllable structure. But let me just say a final few words. One thing that we don't know from these results at all is what is it that's producing these transitions? Where are these bursts coming from? And so where are the bursts coming from? And secondly, where is the sparseness coming from? And so we've done a couple of experiments now. So we have HVC to RA. There's a nucleus that I didn't actually put on that other picture called NIF. So the circuit looks like this. We've done reversible lesion experiments where we can lidocaine. If you put lidocaine in NIF, which blocks neural activity, you completely abolish all sleep bursts in HVC. If you put lidocaine in UVA, you actually increase the sleep bursts, the density of sleep bursts in HVC. So we think that the sleep bursts are actually originating in NIF. And now what we're doing is we're applying the same antidromic activation, antidromic identification procedure to record from HVC projecting NIF neurons. So these, so we're able to record from NIF neurons that project to HVC and record simultaneously from HVC interneurons. And what we found is that the bursts, you get sleep bursts in NIF HVC neurons, meaning NIF neurons that project to HVC, and the density of bursts you see in those neurons is comparable to the interneurons. So what it looks like is that the bursts in HVC are being driven from NIF, but the sparseness of these neurons is actually generated locally within HVC. So there may be some sort of lateral inhibition, some kind of winner-take-all mechanism, something that causes these guys to fire essentially one at a time rapidly through this through a sequence. That's one future direction, which is sort of going to just figure out the dynamics that produce this sequence of states. And then the second direction is to sort of a parallel track is to verify all of those findings in the sleeping bird, in the singing bird. And that's it. Thank you.